Maybe start, introduce all the lights.
Alright, so I am a graduate of this program actually. I was in the SHP from 1999 to 2001. And I was really happy about coming here to lecture, and then I realized that many of you weren't born when I started this program, and that made me really sad. Because I never really thought of myself as being old yet. But anyways, anybody here from Stuyvesant High School?
Actually,
what?
The one girl we had just left.
Why is there only one? What's going on? Okay.
Jersey schools have caught up, and...
Since when did they allow Jersey in here? Never mind. Anyways, sorry. Happy to see you all here. So, I was an SHP, then I did my undergrad here at Columbia, and then after a long roundabout thing, I came back to Columbia's campus. So now I'm faculty in the neuroscience department here, just a few blocks in here. I'm not going to make you code so you can put your laptops away. I'm going to talk about animals. And I'm going to tell you about part of the brain that I study, which is called the hippocampus. And it's one of the best studied, but really one of the most mysterious parts of the brain. And it's really mysterious because it's involved in higher brain function. We as neuroscientists in the lab study animals, and higher brain function and animals don't really go well together experimentally. So maybe part of this lecture will also be me trying to explain to you what kinds of techniques we use in animals to really get at the higher brain functions. So let me start by talking about by introducing the hippocampus. I don't know if any of you have heard about this, but it's part of the brain. As many parts of the brain, it's there are two of them, one in each hemisphere, and it has a silly name, as many other brain areas do, because the first person who cut it out of the brain, which was probably some German anatomist in the 19th century, thought it looked a lot like a seahorse, which it does, and the Latin name for that is the hippocampus, so that's why we have a brain area named hippocampus. It has nothing to do with its function or anything else. But it's found in all vertebrate animals, so from fish all the way up to humans. And it's, as I will explain to you, it's involved in memory, which is part of what makes it really mysterious, because memories are not something that you can observe really easily. Memories are internal to the animal, and they're internal to you. You're probably remembering lots of things right now as I'm speaking, and I have no idea what it is that you're remembering. So, but I can ask you very easily. But I can't ask an animal very easily what they remember. So this lecture will be a little bit about that. The hippocampus, as I said, is found in all animals, in all vertebrate animals. Its position is slightly different only in the brain. So in monkeys, which includes humans, it's found right here. It's just a little bend in the brain. In rats, which is one of the animals that I study, it's found closer to the surface. In birds, it's found on the very surface. Study birds as well. And the function of this brain area has been a puzzle for a very long time. Why? Because let's talk about another brain area. Let's say your visual cortex. If your visual cortex is damaged in some accident, you're not going to be able to see. And that's really, really obvious to any doctor who's going to. If your motor cortex is damaged, you're going to have trouble moving. That's incredibly obvious. So functions of those brain areas have been figured out a long time ago. Whereas not being able to remember, that's a really weird thing, and it's not very obvious to somebody who examines a patient. The breakthrough came in the 1950s with this patient. So actually, when I was studying, we knew him as patient HM. He died when I was in grad school in 2008, and after he died, his name was revealed, so we now know of him as Henry Mollison. And he, when he was growing up as a young man, had horrible epilepsy. As in, he would have a severe epileptic seizure every couple of minutes. He was unable to function at all. And this was in the day in the days of poorly regulated experimental medicine, lots of experimental surgeries were taking place. This was still the era of lobotomies. And there was a doctor, William Scoville, who decided to operate on him and to remove the part of the brain that was creating the epileptic seizures, which was the hippocampus. So he went in and with a spoon removed, a surgical spoon, with an instrument, removed, sucked out the hippocampus by going through the nostrils, essentially, like sucking it out. Anyways, amazingly, his seizures went away. It was just fine. But what was really bizarre is that he developed severe retrograde amnesia. And I will demonstrate to you what this means. So this will actually be, on the next slide, it will be data. The data will not be from HM, it will be from another patient, more recent, but there's now lots of patients that have been characterized this way. So it became pretty obvious to people who were studying him that Henry Mollison had problems with memory. And actually, William Scoville, the surgeon who did the surgery, he collaborated with Brenda Milner, who was a psychologist working at McGill University. She's still alive. She's turning 100 in a month. And she did a lot of psychological tests, and she figured out that there were problems with memory. So how do you measure memory in patient brain or in the lab? One of the ways to do this is to use this thing called the Rey-Usserite complex figure, ROCF. And it's basically a complicated shape which you give to a person. The person has to look at it and then copy it. That's really easy to do, right? The person just looks at the figure and copies it. People do really well, obviously. Then you have the person sit in the dark room for 10 minutes. And then you ask this person to copy this figure from memory. Okay, so this is what a normal, in this case, 54-year-old male, healthy, does. Pretty damn good. You missed like a diagonal line here and maybe a couple of other things. The really nice thing about this figure is that if you count the individual components, there are 18 of them. So you can give the person a score, with 18 being the maximum, of how many of the components that person copied correctly, and that becomes a memory score. These days there are better tests in the lab, but this was, you know, a couple of Austrian psychologists in the 1930s and things. Okay, so this is a normal person. Now we're going to take an age-matched individual who had the misfortune of encephalitis, an infection that killed his hippocampus on both sides of the brain. So first of all, when this person is asked to copy the figure, he does really well. And this is what tells you, this shows why people haven't been able to figure out what the hippocampus is for. Because the person behaves just fine. It means that their hand is moving just fine. They can see just fine. They can follow the doctor's instructions just fine. All of these things are absolutely normal. This person, in fact, on IQ tests, this person will do just fine. So anybody care to guess what score this person gets 10 minutes later when they're asked to copy this figure from memory? 18 being the maximum. Yes? 17, 5, heard a 0 there. All right. 0 sounds fine, right? It was a 0. So this person didn't even remember that he was asked to copy the figure 10 minutes ago. In fact, he didn't recognize the doctor 10 minutes ago. In fact, he didn't know what he was doing and what happened to him. And the doctor had to introduce himself once again. So it's a profound loss of memory without anything else being wrong with this person. And this was the first, this was revolutionary. The first discovery of this was in the 1950s. This was revolutionary because this was the first demonstration that something as complex, abstract, something that's so high brain function as memory, not something stupid, but simple like vision or motor behavior or olfaction or touch, but something like memory can be localized in the brain. And this was followed up by over 50 years of intense research of this brain structure, And I will preamble all this by saying that we have no idea how this brain area implements memory. So this is why I studied this. This is the goal of my life here. So why is this? Well, again, you can't ask an animal in the lab that you're experimenting with to draw the ray asteroid figure. That's too complicated. And this is as simple of a memory test as you can possibly imagine that tests the experiment. It's really hard to read out memory from animals. So most people who have studied the hippocampus, this brain structure, were using rats, and they had rats running around in simple environments. So a typical experiment that you do is you have a rat running around in a box, and you have some recording system that records neurons in the hippocampus of this rat. That's a classic experiment that's been done basically in the 70s, was the first time experiments did this. And what you find is really amazing. So this discovery was made by John O'Keefe. He got the Nobel Prize for it. 1971, they recorded rats running around in a box, and gray trace here is the trajectory of a rat, and each red dot is a spike, an action potential that's fired by this one neuron that they're recording. So you can see that this neuron has firing that's localized to a particular part of the environment, and he called these cells place cells. And this was such an amazing signature of neural activity that people have continued studying this for the next 50 years, even though it's not clear what this has to do with memory. That's a really critical thing. We started out with all this clinical stuff about the importance of the hippocampus for memory, but now people are studying place cells. It's not clear what the relationship is. But the explanation that people gave is that they said, well, look, when you remember something, the most salient thing that you remember about your experience is where you were at the time of the event. Right? That's the classic thing. Almost every event is immediate, like in your life, is tied to a particular location. They said, well, sure, this doesn't explain memory, but this might explain something about at least this one aspect of memory, which is how location, how the person's or animal's location is represented in this memory circuit. And people have continued studying this, and there's lots of amazing phenomenology of these place cells. So for example, if you record many place cells, so this is just what I showed you here, this is just one place cell, right? And instead of using dots for spikes, we can just use a color plot to indicate how many spikes there were in a particular location. So these are, I don't know, 6 by 30 or so place cells that were recorded. And you can see that each place cell has its favorite location. So altogether, these place cells represent the entire environment of the animal. And this was called a map. They said, well, the hippocampus represents a map of the environment, and if you're going to remember things, you're going to tag them to locations on this map. I can think of the map of the neighborhood, and I can recall memories that correspond to various locations on this map. This representation is so localized and covers 100% of the environment, such that you can use place cells to tell where the animal is. If you record enough place cells, you can decode from the activity of place cells the location of the animal. So this is actually from one of my papers, and this is exactly what I did here. And this was first done in 1983, but this is from my data. So in this case, the red is the trajectory of a rat in the environment. And then I had 30-something place cells recorded, and I used the decoder. I won't go into the details of the decoder, and asked this decoder to take the best guess about where the animal is. And you can see that the decoder can follow the animal pretty well. So this was the first time this was done. This was also really incredible, because the ability to read the animal's brain and to figure out something like the animal's location based on that was extremely novel. And these days, it might not seem as unique to us, but it was when it was first discovered. So the hippocampus represents location. That's great. It was followed by the cottage industry, decades of cottage industry, of looking at various features of the spatial representation. For example, people said, well, this is two-dimensional, right? All these place cells are two-dimensional, but animals don't just move in two dimensions. How does this work in 3D? So they recorded place cells in bats, right? With telemetry, with antenna, so that you can transmit neural signals to antenna that are surrounding the bat. The bat is flying in a room. It's a pretty large room, and you can record a neuron as the bat is flying, and you can see that the spikes of this neuron are localized to a particular region of the 3D space. They said, well, what about impossible environments, things that are not physically possible on Earth? How would the hippocampus handle something like this? So they sent rats to space. Okay, this is from almost 20 years ago. This was on the Columbia space shuttle, which had a tragic ending a couple of years later. But this was the Escher staircase, which is this kind of an environment that's impossible to build on Earth because the animal wouldn't be able to walk on it. But they were able to do this in space, and this rat, in the absence of gravity, was walking on this Escher staircase, and lo and behold, hippocampal neurons represent location on this Escher staircase. So it became, over decades of this kind of research, it became really apparent to people that hippocampus is really good at representing spatial features of the animal's behavior. And as this research went on and on and on and on, it became more and more and more and more disconnected and disengaged from the reason the hippocampus is interesting to begin with, which is that it's involved in memory, and that you can't remember new events when something happens. When I started in the hippocampus field studying the hippocampus, I was really caught onto all of these ideas. I was really excited about them, and I wanted to study how the hippocampus represents space. And I thought, well, this is crazy, because if I had to fly to the orbit to do anything interesting, that's not the kinds of experiments that I need to do. And I wanted to create weird environments, maybe impossible ones. I wanted to do things where I could change things rapidly in the environment, like change some visual feature of the environment and see how the hippocampal representations change. I wanted to introduce things that would be a little more like memory, like events, flash of light, or an object that moves, or an object that disappears, things that the animal could remember, and then I could see how the hippocampus responds to them. And these kinds of experiments are either really crazy and require flying on this extremely dangerous ship, or they require, in many cases, for going in and mechanically modifying the environment. So if I wanted to introduce something to the animal in this cardboard box, I would have to go in and glue something to the wall. I said, well, we are now in the 21st century, and there are better ways to do these kinds of experiments. We don't need the animal to navigate in a real environment. We can have the animal play a video game. In video games, you can have anything happen to the animal. So for a couple of years, I was doing a project in which I was building a virtual reality system for rats. Which I thought would be a really good way to study these kinds of things. So I'm going to show you, needless to say, it's an engineering challenge to do this. So I'm going to show you how we've solved this engineering challenge, and I'm going to show you some of the work. So the virtual reality system that I built was based on some other virtual reality systems that people had for other animals, but we had to optimize and modify lots of things. The idea is the following. So there is what we call a treadmill. It's actually just a styrofoam ball, 18 inches. It's sitting in the, so that's this big white ball. It's sitting in this holder, and there are pressurized air jets coming through the holder that suspend the air jet. They suspend the treadmill, this styrofoam ball, in here. So it's like if you play air hockey. Air jets that are coming through the table, and the physical object it becomes really frictionless. So as a result, you can just come up to this treadmill and you can spin it, and it just spins in this direction. And we put the rat on top of it. So now the rat can walk on this treadmill. We don't want the animal to fall off the treadmill, so we actually have him strapped in. I'm going to show you that on the next page. But he's strapped in into something that has like lots of hinges and ball bearings, and it's an attachment that basically allows the animal to rotate through the full 360-degree range. So he can actually physically turn and walk in any direction. Now they have systems like this for humans, actually. You can find people wearing goggles, and they're on the treadmill, and they can turn in any direction to run with a gun, whatever it is that people do in virtual reality games. So then the next component of this is there is a screen. So there's this cone-shaped screen that surrounds the animal, and there's a projector above the animal that projects an image, a rendering, of a virtual environment to the animal. So, and we can figure out the rendering so that it actually looks like a 3D world, and I'm going to show you some videos of this. And the key innovation here was that the ceiling here is transparent, so that we can project everything to the animal without the animal casting shadow on the screen. This is actually, it kind of sounds silly, but this was a major problem that wasn't solved for several years. And we figured out that the way to do this is to have a transparent screen that projects up to the animal. So now the animal is here, and there's a full surround image. Then we have optical sensors that track the rotation of this treadmill, and they feed it to software, which I wrote in MATLAB, and it's called Virtual Reality MATLAB Engine, or Vermin. You can play around with it. It's actually really easy to use, and there's a whole manual. You can just build virtual environments and run through and stuff like this. You can download it from the lab website. So this is what it looked like. So that's the projector right there. This is the cone-shaped screen. My advisor at that time was really into sailing, so we set up this whole system of blocks and ropes so that we could lift up the screen to get access to the animals. So that's how it looks like. Okay, and that's the treadmill right there. And the rat goes on top of the treadmill. Again, we need to make sure that the rat doesn't fall off the treadmill, so we train rats to wear little jackets. So this is the, it's a three-piece jacket. It goes over the legs, and then there's a little strap for the abdomen, and there's a backbone that has a magnet on it. So the animal just gets magnetically snapped into this holder. And there's a little lick tube, so we can deliver liquid rewards for licking as reward for performing the task. Okay? And the last component here, there's a recording system. Okay, so that's a jacket, this is a rotating arm, this is a lick tube, and there's a recording system right here, which we can use, and it's miniaturized and compacted. We can use this to record neurons from the brain, for example, while he's running around in virtual reality. Okay, so I'm going to show you a video of this. Don't worry for the moment about what exactly the animal is doing. I just wanted to show you what the mechanics of running on this treadmill are like.
Maybe I should wear the window shades?
Let's see what this is like. I think it's a good concept. Yeah, that's fine. Right. So he's running around. You can see that he can turn. They do interesting stuff, like they will run parallel to walls, which is one of these cases, we'll see him stop, and maybe the next one, or maybe it already happened, but they don't run into walls, which is amazing, because it's a virtual wall, but they kind of understand it. So they're really playing this as a human would play a video game. There you go, you see he's running parallel to this.
Is there a mechanism built in so that if they try to walk on the wall, the ball won't run over the wall?
No, we didn't even build in brakes. That would have been really difficult to do, and we thought that it would be the real reason. We didn't want any instances when the ball stopped, because during those instances, if the animal pushes against the ball, it will actually snap out of the holder and fly off the projector. So we wanted to make sure that the there was never any force counteracting the force of the animal.
So if you want,
I learned it the hard way, but sorry. If he wants, no, so if he runs into the wall, the same thing happens as in also the image.
So if you keep running, the thing won't
move. He will keep running, but the image won't move.
Got it.
Exactly. So, so using the software that I wrote, with I made these like fantastical environments, kind of Alice in Wonderland type environments. There's some like tongue-in-cheek stuff in here. Like this is an actual recording of an environment that's on the wall. But anyways, so the cool thing is designing, you know, building an environment in the lab is like a multi-group procedure of buying stuff and machining it and drilling holes and screwing stuff together, and it's, and then you just have one environment. Whereas with virtual reality, you just sit on your laptop and you draw a cool little world for the rat to run in, and then you can put the rat in it 5 minutes later, which is really a lot of fun for us. So what I'm going to show you now is a recording of a neuron in the hippocampus of a rat in this exact environment. So what you're going to see is on top, you're going to see the rat's point of view. So this is what the rat is seeing. On the bottom, you see a top-down view of the environment. And this little blue symbol indicates where the rat is. And you will see the rat's trajectory, and then you will also see and hear, so you will actually be listening to a recording of the neuron in the hippocampus. Okay? I think it's pretty quiet, so just listen. So he runs through the environment. So this neuron fired spikes right there. He's making another circle through the environment. And he goes for a spin. Rats love doing that. Right, he walked out. So this is a place cell, which is spectacular because the animal's not actually moving. He's just virtual moving, right? So posterity. There we go. Every time the animal runs through this virtual location in the video game, this neuron fires. The animal is not stupid. I mean, the animal knows that he's sitting on the same treadmill. He can see these components of the setup. He's strapped into the jacket. This movement is not completely natural. For example, lots of vestibular components of the movement are lacking. So he knows that he's not accelerating the same way. He's just running on the treadmill. But the brain represents the location of the virtual environment. And this was a really big deal because it shows that, look, it's not real location, it's kind of perceived location that this brain area represents. And perhaps it's not even perceived location, but it's just a symbolic location. It's a representation of where the animal is in the task that he's performing. So I mostly just wanted to show you this method because it's really cool. We've done a lot of stuff with it, published it, and lots of labs are continuing to use this virtual reality system, but I want to move on to talk about some of this stuff. Anybody has questions about this VR system?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, in this case, is it basically the only stimulus is basically a visual stimulus? Right?
Exactly.
So,
well, okay, so you're getting at something really interesting here, which is, it's not only visual vision is involved here. The second component is the vestibular rotational component. So when the animal rotates, there is acceleration. And there are organs that sense acceleration, or vestibular organs in the inner ear can sense the acceleration. So technically, it's not only visual inputs that he's getting, he's also getting vestibular inputs. And this turned out to be critical because for several years prior to this project, people had built virtual reality systems in which animals were not allowed to rotate, and they were not able to get the hippocampus to be active in the proper way. So it seems that those two components, the visual and the stimulus.
Does it know how those cells are when they're assigned to
Also, very good question. So, part of what I'm about to talk about is related to that. But no, it's not known. And the first time you ever place an animal in an environment, all of a sudden place cells pop up and get assigned to different locations of the environment. It's like first exposure to the environment, some cells step up to the challenge and start representing the location. Nobody knows how that's done, nobody knows the mechanisms, completely unknown. All the stuff that we know about the hippocampus is just observation, but it's not mechanistic.
Mm-hmm. Can I follow up to that? Is there any similarity or link between, let's say, the same place cell, if it was lighting up in a different environment? Is there any correlation between
them? Yeah, so I could probably give an entire lecture on this. So, no. The answer is no. So if you have place cell, let's say one environment, place cell A, place cell B, place cell C, you go to the other environment, place cell A might not even be active anymore, and then place cell C would be active before place cell B, and then another place cell D would be active. So there's absolutely no correlation. It's like the representations of different environments are completely different. It's like the hippocampus builds a different map of each environment, and with no relationship between them, and we don't know that.
So I'm guessing there isn't like a particular population of neurons that you just call place cells and that always take this responsibility, or is it just like all different kinds of cells might take the role of a place cell and environment?
So if you record the hippocampus in a given environment, 40% of the cells in the hippocampus are active and are place cells. 60% of the cells are silent. So you might ask, what do the other 60% of the cells do? So then you take the animal, and you move the animal to a different environment. 40% of cells are active in a different environment. But they're different 40%. They're overlapping with the 40% that were active in the first environment, but only partially overlap. And then you go to the third environment, and another 40%. And the fourth environment, and another 40%. And this has been taken on to 11 environments, not me. So it's not done in Manhattan. It has that much space. It's kind of above the Arctic Circle more. Anyways, and you discover that it's just a matter of how many environments you've reported in. Every cell will eventually be a place.
Okay. And then, is there like
sort of
a set size thing if you put like an animal? Space, does the actual absolute area covered by the
small
space, or does it like?
No, it's not. It's more like a relative space. Yeah. So about 15% of the environment is covered by a place field, and I've actually done this. It's a really easy thing to do in virtual environment. You just type in a different variable, and all of a sudden the environment becomes twice as big. And place cells actually become larger. So it's not really a representation of location in the GPS. You know? When the Nobel Prize was given to these cells, they hold the brain's GPS. It's not really something like that. It's something more abstract. It's like some partition of the environment into behavioral units where each cell represents a particular behavioral unit. And you know, if you are a pilot who flies thousands of miles, you know, you're not going to have, during that flight, you're not going to have place cells, each one of which is, 25 centimeters, right? You're probably going to be like, oh, I'm on this 20-hour flight from New York to Singapore, and I have a place cell that represents all of that. This doesn't really matter to me where exactly in Africa I am. I just know that I'm kind of flying above Africa. I don't think that flight will actually go over it. You get the point.
The one last question. If you move an animal to from environment A to environment B, then back to environment A, would it use the same place cells to represent the area?
Yes. So if you repeatedly move the animal back to the same environment, day after day, you get the same kinds of representations. With a little bit of just noise, you occasionally find out that a cell just stopped being active.
Okay.
Or another cell became active out of it.
But it's not randomly.
It's not randomly reallocated. But the reason telling you about these like little noisy things is because if representations are completely stable, that's a completely useless system for memory.
Yeah.
Memory is about change, right? Memory is about you get a new memory, something has to change. So we'll get to this because nobody's actually studying memory. Okay. So this is what this place still looks like. So going back to, I think, one of the questions that was asked relates to how does a place cell get assigned to a particular environment. So the question is, where does all the spatial information come from? Think about it. Calculating space is not really that trivial. If I ask you, how would you calculate the sound frequency that you're hearing? And you say, well, that's a trivial thing. I have this thing called the cochlea, which is long, and different parts of it are tuned to different sound frequencies. So calculating, figuring out what sound frequency I'm hearing is really easy. I just figure out which part of the cochlea is getting stimulated. But you don't have an organ for place. Right? We don't have an organ in our body for place. Place is something that we calculate. You know, I look here, and I see that building, and I kind of know where it is, and I know where it is relative to my apartment. Right? That's a mental calculation thing. So how does this calculation happen? And when you're looking at a brain area, you want to figure out how a calculation happens. You want to see where the inputs into that area come from. And the inputs into the hippocampus come from a part of the brain called the entorhinal cortex. The entorhinal cortex is the interface between the hippocampus and basically the rest of the brain. That's how the rest of the brain conveys signals to the hippocampus. So an obvious thing, if you want to understand how the hippocampus does something, is to go up into the entorhinal cortex to report it. So this is what people have been trying to do for many years. And nothing made sense. You report in the hippocampal in the internal cortex, and things don't really seem to be related to location. Which was really bizarre, because in the hippocampus, everything is about location, but you would record in the internal cortex, and it seemed to be completely unrelated to location. So the mystery was solved by an anatomist called Menno Witter, who was working with a couple of very lucky experimentalists. And they told him, you know, we're recording in the internal cortex, and it's not making sense. He said, well, where in the internal cortex are you recording? And this is a slice of the rat brain. So this is the front of the brain, this is the back of the brain. And the internal cortex is this part of the brain. Okay? And they said, well, I don't know, we're just putting it in the middle of the internal cortex. Right here. We have our recording device, and it's just going into the middle of the internal cortex. He said, for the last 10 years, I've been looking at the connections between the internal cortex and the hippocampus, and this is the wrong part of the internal cortex to be recording, because the part of the internal cortex that connects to the part of the hippocampus where all these beautiful place cells are is right here. It's not down here. It's right here. It's a couple of millimeters above. So he said, why aren't you recording in this part of the internal cortex? And he said, we can't, because there's a gigantic blood vessel there. That's really the only reason. There's a big blood vessel there, and you can't puncture the blood vessel. Obviously, people are doing the hard way too. So you kind of just move your recording device back a little, and you go into this part of the internal cortex. And he said, well, stop whining. Just tilt your drive a little bit and go at an angle. So that's exactly what they did, and they got the Nobel Prize for what they found. So this was a pair of lucky experimentalists, Edward Moser. And I'm going to show you the same exact thing. So this is a rat in a real environment. He's running around. There are LEDs on his head, so they're kind of glowing. You will see a hand here occasionally come out and throw chocolate pellets into the environment. That's a grad student. Okay, and you will see dots appear every time this one cell in the internal cortex is firing spikes. Okay, so here it is. Right. So first of all, you already see that this is not like a place cell because it's active all over the place. Right? This cell is not active in a localized part of the environment. It's active kind of randomly. All right, so we're going to speed this up. Still seems pretty random, but you might be you might be noticing some interesting things here. The places where this cell is active are organized in a grid. It's a hexagonal lattice. And they called these cells grid cells. And this is something that they couldn't even believe because it just looked like some artifact. So if you're recording the right part of the internal cortex, there are actual things that are related to the thalamus activation. Except instead of representing it in a place-like fashion, like a place cell would represent location, this is more like a Manhattan grid representation of location. It's different from Manhattan grid because it's not a rectangular grid, it's a hexagonal grid, right? In a rectangular grid, this angle would be 90 degrees, but instead this is 60 degrees.
Okay.
So this is one of the grid cells that I couldn't believe this until I recorded grid cells in the rat, so this is one of my recordings. So why would representing location using a hexagonal lattice be good? Well, if you look in nature, there's actually lots of representations of space. There's lots of things are organized in hexagonal lattices. These are just two examples, right? That's a hexagonal lattice. These are nesting cormorants. You can see that they organize their nests in this desert along a hexagonal lattice. This is a perfect hexagon right here. Okay. So, and if you go to a supermarket, oranges are often sitting in a hexagonal lattice. So that's a very good way of packing things into space. So we still have no idea why the brain would represent location this way, but there are some things. So, that's the hippocampus in rats and the internal cortex in rats. Let's go back in the next few minutes. I'm going to go back to kind of the very basic question about hippocampus. And the basic question is that we still don't understand memory. All right, I started out with this amazing result that if you get rid of the hippocampus, humans don't remember their doctor that they talked to 10 minutes ago. What do place cells and grid cells have anything to do with that? And the reason we still don't understand this 50 years later, I think, is that this behavior of a rat running around in a box, or the 21st century version of it, of a rat running around in a video game, those behaviors don't actually require memory. The animal can walk around in an environment searching for chocolate pellets without any use of memory. It just needs to walk around until it sees a chocolate pellet and then eat it. That doesn't require any memory at all. Same way, in the virtual reality system that I built, animals just need to run on a treadmill. They love doing that. But there's absolutely no use of memory. So people study these animals in the lab without requiring them to do anything that requires memory. And it's not that the entire field of scientists is stupid and they're not doing the right thing. It's that it's really, really hard to get an animal to do something that requires memory. Because as I said at the beginning, memories are internal, so you can't ask the animal, what do you remember, oh rat? Right? I mean, that the rat is probably remembering a lot of stuff, but there's no behavioral readout. And in order to study memory, we need something where there is a behavioral readout. So I had this kind of, at this point 3 years ago, it's a crisis of, existentialist crisis, I guess, where I thought that if I study this, these beautiful cells for the next 50 years, I'm just gonna go down in history with all the other people for the last 50 years that have been studying this, and I will not solve the problem of memory. And the Nobel Prize has already been given for this, so what am I doing? Anyways, I decided that we need to study a different animal. The rat is not the correct animal to study here, because rats don't tell us what they remember. We need an animal that would tell us what it remembers. And there's a long-standing tradition in neuroscience of choosing your model organism based on what you want to study and choosing a genius at the particular behavior. Right? So rats are really good at running around. They're geniuses at running around, so they're chosen for this behavior. But when it comes to memory, we need to choose an animal that's a genius at memory. And in the animal kingdom, the champions of memory are birds, particular kinds of birds. So I'm going to show you one of them. This is not a bird that I studied. This is called the... he's actually...
It looks so big.
This bird is about the size of a crow, so it's kind of big. The birds that I study are way smaller than this. So this is spotted nutcracker. It's a bird that lives in Siberia. It specializes in pine nuts. And you're going to see this behavior. So he's going to grab a bunch of these pine nuts, put them in a pouch. He's going to cache them into the ground. I mean, you've seen animals do this kind of stuff, right? So he's going to cache them, and he's going to disguise it. And then he hops to another location. He's going to cache. I really don't know what it is that he's looking for, but all right, he found another location. I love to show this video in its entirety. that one's just not good enough. There you go. Okay, so they go around, and in the fall, when the pine nuts are available, they go around and they cache thousands of these food items. Tens, hundreds of thousands of these food items. And then they eat them throughout the winter, and they recover them, even continue eating them in the spring and feeding their young. So it's pretty obvious how memory would be really useful to these kinds of animals, because vision is not good enough for this. They're disguising their own catch sight. So they need to remember. In order to have advantage over other things in the forest that are trying to steal their food, they need to have good memory. And so I showed you a video of the spotted nutcracker just because it's a cute video I was able to find on YouTube. But the animal that I studied here is an animal that's local to New York. And one of the food caching species here is the black-capped chickadee. So this is my hand. So it tells you the scale of this bird. It's pretty small. We cache them, so they live throughout North America. We cache them in upstate New York. And they are also really driven to cache. They are so driven to cache that I'm going to show you this animal caching in somewhat inappropriate places. Okay, so this is a wild bird, and he caches the first seed into the sleeve of this one.
That's not me.
Okay. And then this one is going to go into the belt. He chases away the other guy. And this one, I think, is going to go into the pocket. There we go. So these animals are so driven to shove food into whatever locations are available to them that they will do it even when those locations are not particularly appropriate. Okay. So these are the most intense food caching birds that live up here and that are available to us. Relatives of these species also live throughout Northern Europe. As you saw from both of these videos, this is an adaptation to pretty harsh climates. So some of the best studies of these birds have been done in Northern Europe, Scandinavia, and Russia. So one of the studies that I'm going to show you was done on this island in the White Sea, just a few miles away from the Arctic Circle. Okay, it looks like this wonderful winter paradise, but it's actually hell on earth, because these are the typical winter conditions. Typical lows, minus 25 degrees. It snows 23 days of the month. And because it's so close to the Arctic Circle, we only get 3 hours of daylight, okay?
Is it each day or all of it?
That's, you mean the three-hour daylight?
Well,
yeah, that's per day.
It's not
above yet. It's below the Arctic Circle, so you do get a little bit of sunlight per day. 3 hours. Okay, so let's think about this. These are basically the only birds that stay up here. Everybody else just pokes in and goes south, right? Because as a little bird with high metabolism, high surface area to body mass ratio, you don't do really well here. So, for example, fat layers have been measured in these birds, and they burn through their entire fat layer to the muscle overnight. So they wake up with zero fat reserves left. After starving for 21 hours, they get 3 hours to eat enough to survive for the next 21 hours. And on 23 of the 31 days, their entire food source is covered by snow. If they are lucky, if they're not unlucky, it's ice. Okay? So the only way these birds survive is by caching large amounts of food in advance. That's the only way they survive. They have an adaptation for this. This is what they do. So this is actual data. You might ask, how is this data acquired? Because this is in the forest. The answer is that this data was acquired by feeding birds radioactive seeds. It's alpha radiation, so it's fine. Anyway, so they take these seeds and they catch them, and then somebody goes around with Geiger counter and presumably personal protection and finds these seeds in the forest. So this is the way these seeds are tracked in the forest, and you can see that this one bird has scattered these food items throughout what's basically a third of a football stadium here. So these are the kinds of experiments you were allowed to do in England in the 80s. I don't think they would allow me to do this in the same year. Anyways, so they cache food and they scatter it throughout the environment. They're called scatter quarters. Okay? And it's pretty obvious how memory would be a really good thing for these animals to have. Because how on earth would you go back and find these seeds after you cache them? They're all over the place. And this is not like some pristine white surface, this is a forest. There's lots of objects there. So, just to tell you the numbers, in the fall, these birds cache a food item every 20 seconds. So they're just feeding and caching, feeding, caching, feeding, caching, feeding, caching. And the numbers are, and this was directly counted by observing these birds with binoculars in the forest, they cache over 7,000 food items per day.
Individual seeds.
Yeah, so these birds actually cache individual seeds. The video that I showed you at the beginning was multiple seeds, but the chickadees that I study, they cache one seed per location. And yes, and they cache over 7,000 per day, which adds up to 500,000 per year. And as I will show you on the next slide, they remember this location. So they outperform humans on memory tasks. by far, right? And it's a tiny bird. For decades, people wouldn't believe that they actually use memory because, you know, we're humans, we think we're special. So, fine, okay, some animals run better than us, okay. Some animals swim better than us, some animals fly better than us. But when it comes to something cognitive like memory, there was a lot of resistance to believing that animals can actually do that better than us. But these animals can. So, this is some data. So this is a bird in outdoor aviary. It caches food items, so each cross here is an individual food item. And then it's taken away for 24 hours, and it's put back in. And then somebody observes where this bird did sleep in. And this is what the bird does. So each green dot here is a correct search. And then in this entire session, this bird incorrectly made digs in 4 spots, and also incorrectly omitted 2 of these. I challenge anybody here to do this. There's no way you can do this. Okay? The important thing is I told you about the hippocampus and how the hippocampus is important for memory. These birds have a hippocampus, and if you lesion the hippocampus, surgically remove it, this is what happens. First of all, these birds continue caching seeds. So that behavior is not influenced. They have the same drive to go and hide the food. But when you put these birds back into the environment, this is what the bird does. So he's randomly guessing. This is the bird version of patient HM. So we couldn't remember anything after his encounter. Okay.
What happened to him? Yeah. Did they let him live the rest of his life in a beautiful cage full of seeds?
This is that. I would really love to tell you a good story that this bird was happily lived ever after, but the paper that I read contains images of the slices of his brain so, to show the extent of the lesions. Yes, he was not let out into the wild to starve. So, you know, this was actually done in 1966 in Siberia, and this study wasn't known for decades because it was behind the Iron Curtain and was never translated from Russian to English. But there were researchers in the West who independently got these results. So, okay. So when I decided that this is the animal that I want to study. So I want to study animal behavior in the lab. This is the animal. I don't want to be studying a rat that's running around and it's not clear what memory the animal is using, because here I have a very clear behavioral readout of memory. I know exactly what the animal remembers, when he remembers it. I have a behavioral readout. If there's behavioral deficit, I can. So when I started my lab last year at Columbia, we started getting these birds in the wild, bringing them into the lab. We started figuring out how one could work with these birds in the lab. And the thing that I was really, really afraid of, you know, I'm starting my own lab, getting students, convincing people to work with me on this. I thought, what if I bring these birds to Columbia, to this building, and they just refuse to catch? I have no idea how. I never worked with these birds. I have no idea how to make an animal cache food. Sure, they do it in the wild, but I'm gonna have them do this in a small lab, in artificial environments. What if it just doesn't work? So I was terrified of this. We found out very quickly that was not something we should be afraid of, because you can't stop these birds from caching. They're so driven to do this that they can't help themselves. It's such a natural behavior. That's a really big advantage of studying a natural behavior. So I'm going to share with you. So with my student, we were testing things out. So we built this little arena, and there are feeders here, and we were just looking at how birds would find food and retrieve it from these feeders. So what you're going to see is a bird that flies to one of these feeders. So this is a little chickadee. All right, so he flies to one of these feeders in the lab, grabs it, it's a plastic 3D printed feeder. Found a seed in that one, flies back with the seed, and then discovers that the security camera case has a crack in it. So he goes on with caches the seed in this crack. Okay? So we said, well, that's an illegal location, that's not what we want him to do. So we took the bird out, opened it, took the seed out of the crack of the security camera, put the bird back in. Half an hour later, this is what the bird does. Sorry, I don't think I started when you get there. So half an hour later, this is what the bird does. He actually pecks at the camera, if you could hear the sound. I'm trained to not anthropomorphize, and I'm trained to not rely on anecdotal N of one observations and to get lots of data and do statistics. But when I saw this, I said, it's gonna work. Because this animal's clearly looking for his food, and he's pretty damn frustrated that his food, which he remembers was there, is not there anymore. So, of course, we didn't want these birds to cache. Actually, one of the biggest challenges of running this whole project is coming up with environments that don't have any cracks or crevices or rubber insulation or whatever else, because these birds will immediately locate things that look like cacheable locations, and they will go and they will cache food there. I'll just share with some of them. So in our animal facility, we have these cage cards that say the animal ID. So this is gray 98 that it's band is great, it has number 98 on it. And they learn that they can stick their heads out through here and shove sunflower seeds in here. So what happened is these cage cards would bulge up so much they would actually fall on the floor, and then the janitors were complaining to us. This is a little LED circuit, so it's just to light the cage, and there's a sunflower seed shoved under a capacitor. This is a little mealworm that's been very carefully threaded behind the bars.
Oh my God.
So, Yeah, you can't stop these birds to catch. They'll just do it. So our challenge is not to get these birds to catch, but to route this behavior into something that is actual a scientific instrument that's compatible with neural recordings, that's compatible with behavioral observations, with automated processes. After kind of playing around with this, the environment that we came up with, it looks something like this. So it's kind of like a forest canopy with lots of branches that the birds can hang onto. And there are these little rubber-covered locations that are perfect, because birds love to kind of peel things away and shove seeds underneath. That's what they do in the wild. They will often shove seeds into the like soft bark of a tree. So we kind of mimic. We saw lots of videos of these behaviors. That video of the woman holding a bird catches all over that. She's Leslie the bird nerd on YouTube, and she has lots of videos of chickens and all sorts of crazy stuff. I highly recommend. Anyways, so we found out that chickadees like to cache into these kinds of locations, and we were able to build an environment that has all of these things and important thing, no other kinds of places where they could cache. If you notice these little white peaks, you might ask, what is that? Well, so they're screws, right? And these white things cover screw caps. Otherwise, birds will shove, you know how there's a hole for the screwdriver? Birds will shove seeds into that little hole for the screwdriver. So we need to cover them, because that's not where we want those birds to catch. So these are the kinds of things that we learned the hard way over the last year, but we now have this environment. And the really critical thing about this environment is that it has a transparent bottom. So we can actually put a camera underneath and we can see where the bird is putting food. And that's really important, because we can do completely automated tracking of the bird's behavior. So this becomes very kind of objective. We can put the bird in, track the bird, caching, retrieving. Now we have a data set of looking at cache sites, bird's behavior. We can do analysis on it, and hopefully in the future do neural recordings of the birds in the campus while the bird is doing these things. So I'm going to show you what it looks like. And by the way, this is just right now a small kind of 2-foot by 2-foot arena, but you can imagine how you just scale this up. Have it cover the whole room if you need to. It's very easy to do. So, but right now this is a small prototype version of the arena. So this is it again in my lab. Little chickadee here, there are sunflower seeds in the feeder. So what you're going to see is he's going to grab a sunflower seed, and he's going to cache it right here. There you go. Grabs another sunflower seed, he's going to cache it somewhere here. Yep, there you go. And actually, unfortunately, it's a low-resolution camera, but if you look closely, the way he does it is he peels the rubber and pulls it down with his leg, puts the seed in, and then releases the leg to snap it back. We never had to teach them to do this, they just learn it. Because it's very natural for these birds. Okay, and as I told you, the important thing here is that the bottom is transparent, so what I can show you the bottom view of this cache site, and you will see that when the bird caches a food item, what happens here? There we go. Some chunk of sunflower seed appears right there, actually. So we can just analyze, do some image analysis of this, and figure out where seeds appear and disappear. It becomes not just a fun caching playground, but it becomes a piece of scientific instrumentation. Okay, and this works. So when we analyze where the bird spends his time, so if he, at the beginning, he kind of spends his time uniformly throughout the arena. This is a distribution, colors in the distribution. But then he caches some seeds, and then what we do is we do something evil. We remove those seeds, put the bird back in, and ask, where does the bird look for seeds? And he winds up spending most of his time in the vicinity of these seeds. So this is really exciting, because in the lab, in a very artificial environment, a wild hawk bird just comes in and starts using this artificial apparatus to do what chickadees do best. And I'm just going to leave you here with this image. We just started doing neural recordings in these birds, so we are getting, literally last week, we started getting our first recordings in the hippocampus of these birds. So we don't know anything yet about them, but I think that we're going to be able to see representations of memories. That's my hope, to try to understand what the neural code is of a memory. in this case, a very specialized memory, the memory of a cache site. But because it's the same brain area that's used for memory in humans, I really hope that this will teach us something that's universal. This is a device that we designed that weighs 1 gram, and it has movable electrodes and amplifiers and filters and all the electronics right there on the back of this drive. And we can record from, in this case, at least 64 electrodes that go into the hippocampus of the bird. And birds can fly there. It's just 1 gram. So that's it. Questions? More questions about the rat virtual reality system. Come on, this is even more exciting than that. Yeah.
So you set up in like the experiment done during like the 20th century, like the ones like done in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Like once they scratch the hippocampus or whatever, like I noticed that they like still kind of like went to like the general like areas.
Yeah, that's a very keen observation. So let's go back to that plot. Yeah, so they're kind of still clustering their locations here and here. So there were a couple of things that kind of contaminated this experiment. First of all, this is the location where they were typically fed. So they had a positive association with that location. It wasn't an individual memory, but they had a kind of a general vague preference for that location. And then there are also a lot, you know, because this was done in an outdoor aviary, I think the description of that paper says that there was a tree stump somewhere here. So they probably just spent more time there because it's a more kind of likely place to find stuff, because there are lots of cracks and things like this. So it's not, you know, it was 1966, and it was done with zero automation. It's not, you know, at a field site in Siberia. It wasn't a carefully done experiment. And most of these experiments were not very carefully done experiments because of the limitations of experimenting. Lots of limitations. So this needs to be done better in lab conditions, and the kind of an apparatus that we're building here, you know, this is, they shouldn't have very strong preferences because all of these locations are the same. Turns out that they do have preferences even in this place. Like they would prefer, we actually removed the speeder after a while because they had very strong preference for locations around the theater. But even still, they tend to like locations near the center of the environment. Maybe they feel safer there. I don't know. So lots of experiments have to be done, and these kinds of biases need to be measured statistically. And if we do any measurements, we have to compensate for intrinsic biases of the animal. And that can only be done in a very well-controlled laboratory setting. You can't do it in an outdoor aviary where, you know, the weather is different every day.
In the experiment that you just talked about, the one that was mentioned, did they remove the hippocampus before or after the bird initially cached the seeds?
Before.
Yeah. Okay, I'm just curious because I remember I read an article a few years ago that was had something to do with how certain drugs in the hippocampus were responsible for forming memory rather than like retaining.
Yeah. So this brings us to, so this is really interesting. This surgery, I mean, those are heroic experiments because they were done in field conditions in Siberia in 1966. But they removed the hippocampus with the spoon, with the surgical stash. And you couldn't do, so what you are implying here is that a really interesting experiment would be, instead of removing the hippocampus before the caching, you'd allow the animal to cache, then remove the hippocampus, then allow the animal to retreat, because maybe in that case the animal would do just fine. Can't do that with lesions because this is a pretty brutal surgery. It requires the animal several days to recover from the surgery. Whereas these memories, to get a clear readout, they want it to happen within 24 hours. But there are other ways of doing this. You can inactivate the hippocampus. You can infuse a drug into the hippocampus that would inactivate, turn off brain activity, and then wash it out. You could get a much faster time course. These days, you can inactivate neurons with light. There's optogenetics. You could have shine light, turn the neurons off, and then turn the light off, and the neurons are back on. So these are the kinds of quick experiments that we want to do, chickpeas in the lab. Now that we're actually doing this in the 21st century, and we have all of these techniques available to us. We don't have as many techniques available for birds as there are for mice, let's say. But over the last year, in my lab, we tried out a bunch of these things, and they seem to work just fine. So we can inject viruses into the bird to express some of these optically sensitive opsins. We've also, in the past, I've worked with birds in the past too. I've studied singing birds actually before this. There are devices that we've developed for infusing pharmacological agents into the brain. So all that kind of stuff is possible. And yes, we don't know the answers to these because nobody's ever done this in the modern world with all the modern neuroscience techniques in an animal that's actually remembering. But we'll figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more interested in recording because I'd like to see neurons too, but we are planning to do these kind of temporary inactivation. That's in the works.
And you're planning using different techniques about surgery?
Yeah, because surgical removal is it's not reversible. We want stuff that is reversible. So yes, I wish I had. It's gonna take me too long to find it, but I have pictures of these little reservoirs that you can put on the bird's head that are filled with drug, and they're infusing mucinol, which inactivates neurons into the brain. So yeah, we're planning to. We're just getting started. It took us. You know, I started my lab last year. And we, when we built things up, it was the middle of the breeding season, so we didn't want to be catching birds in the wild. So we waited until the end of the breeding season, and then in September we started catching birds. So now we have a big colony of chickpeas here in Colombia. And we just started figuring it out, so we took us several months to develop this behavioral apparatus. Electrophysiological techniques. We're just starting. It's really exciting. Mm-hmm.
It seemed like when you watched the video of the
chickpea
flying around the arena, there were like colored shapes on the walls.
Yeah.
Is that why was it done?
So it's typical when you study the hippocampus, you give animals visual cues so that they can orient themselves better, because otherwise it's a little hard to figure out which way you're facing. I'm actually planning to, instead of having physical, colorful shapes on the walls, to do what I did in the virtual reality system, have a projector that projects images to them, to turn this into like an augmented reality view, which would be really easy to do. And then we could actually put the bird into a different part of a virtual forest every day and have the bird behave in a different way. Project a different arrangement of trees or other objects to the animals. So that's, we're planning to do that. Yeah, I thought about this. So there's one way to avoid it, which is instead of projecting from the top, to have projectors, like a back projection. You know, in theaters, you will sometimes have a screen, and the projector is behind the screen because the screen is kind of partially translucent. You could have back projection, so the bird is on the different side of the screen from the projector. So that would be a solution to this. That being said, I thought, well, this is really a problem. I mean, birds cast shadows all the time in the wild. Fly on their shadow. So maybe it's not really such a good problem.
What if the bird has to fly through the wall? Like, do you think that's kind of a problem?
Yeah. They're smart enough not to. I mean, they see that it's a physical wall. They don't really do that unless they really freak out.
Yeah.
Yeah, but mostly they You know, when you put them in here, they're pretty obsessed with the fact that there's a lot of food here and places to catch it, and they're not really interested in the walls.
Okay. You will occasionally perch up on the lines.
You mean in our setup or in the wild?
In the wild.
No, so in the wild, it depends on the species. So the first bird that I showed you was spotted nutcracker. They are ground birds. They mostly feed on the ground and they cache into the ground. Chickadees are an arboreal species, so they cache mostly into the trees, usually either a little crevices in the bark, under the bark, you know, in the clumps of leaves, sometimes in the ground, but rarely. So this was meant to kind of replicate what chickadees would be likely to cache into in the wild, which is lots of wooden perches with kind of little flexible materials that you can shove seeds into. Yeah, so obviously ideally we would make this a full kind of 3D thing, but then I'm thinking, how am I going to do neural recordings? We need a cable going to the animal, and then they're just going to get themselves tangled up. The alternative, of course, is not to have a cable, but to have an antenna that transmits the signals. If we're going to have an antenna, we need a battery on the bird, and these birds are really small, and we're already limited in the amount of weight we can put on their heads, so we would need to find a really light battery, and this becomes a problem, so I said, let's just stick with a 2D arrangement. But in the future, I think we'll be able to maybe put a little battery backpacks on birds, and all that kind of stuff. There's lots of cool technology there that could be used. Great.
Next time, May 5th, is our last class. We're going to close off with a Cinco de Mayo themed party and have cake and miracle berries. We'll do a problem set that I mentioned, similar to last week, with all different types of plots, so box plots, scatter plots, histograms, and interpret papers. And we'll do a Kahoot on neurobiology. There'll also be my last SHP class, and I'm moving to London at the end of August, so we'll celebrate the end of my 3 years here. Yeah, I'm moving to University College London, or UCL, where John Keefe, the manager of the Piss Cellar, is from. And he actually did his undergrad, I think, at City College.
He did his, John O'Keefe did his undergrad, City College.
Because I remember he came back and gave a guest lecture after he went at CCNY, which is on 137th Street.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, lots of these discoveries about the campus happened in New York.
That was
down,
really
soon,
good.
Soon be downstate as well.
You guys can pack up, head out.